If I were to just start humming a very specific bass line right now, just a simple, menacing bum 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 bum.
Oh, I know exactly where you're going with this.
Right. A very specific image pops into your head. You don't see a meadow or a peaceful sunrise. You see a kick line.
You see bowler hats.
Exactly. Bowler hats and maybe some torn fishnet stockings. And you probably start picturing a smoky nightclub where the MC is staring just a little too intensely right at you.
Or you picture Liza Minnelli in a sequin vest just belting her lungs out about how life is a cabaret.
Yes, exactly. Or if I changed it up and started singing, "Start spreading the news, you were instantly transported to Times Square," or a New York Yankees game.
With Frank Sinatra crooning in the background. Yeah, those aren't just tunes anymore. They're basically the architectural soundtrack of the 20th century.
They really are.
They've completely transcended the stage to become part of the actual vocabulary of American life. I mean, you hear New York, New York at weddings and funerals and baseball games. It is completely unavoidable.
But here is the paradox that absolutely drives me crazy. We all know the songs. You know Chicago, you know Cabaret. But if you stopped a random person on the street today and asked, "Who is John Kander?"
They would probably just look at you blankly.
Total blank stare.
It's that classic case of the art outliving the artist while the artist is actually still alive. Because the music is loud and brash and deeply cynical, but the man behind it is, he's remarkably quiet.
So today we are fixing that. We're doing a deep dive into the life, the career, and the surprisingly normal background of John Kander.
Very normal.
We're pulling from biographical records, career retrospectives, and Wikipedia specifically to look at the mechanics of how this guy works. Because looking at our source material, this is a guy who has been active since the Eisenhower administration and is still writing musicals in the 2020s. He's 98 plus years old.
And what we're going to find as we go through this is that Kander's story isn't just a laundry list of Tony Awards. It's really a masterclass in longevity and collaboration and a very specific way of looking at the world.
Yeah, we are going to answer the question of how a polite, middle-class boy from Kansas City ended up defining the darkest, sexiest, most cynical era of Broadway history.
It's quite a journey. From a second grade math class to the murderesses of Cook County Jail.
Let's actually start right there at the beginning. Who is John Kander before all the accolades? Because usually when you have a composer who writes extensively about Nazis and murder and corruption, you expect some sort of tortured childhood.
You really do, but you would be completely wrong in this case. If you look at the records, his upbringing in Kansas City, Missouri in the 1920s and 30s was aggressively normal.
Aggressively normal. I love that.
It was. He was born in 1927. His father, Harold, worked in the poultry and egg business. His mom, Bernice, was a homemaker.
So there's no starving artist in a freezing garret story here.
No.
No running away from home to join the circus.
Far from it. It was a very loving, supportive, middle-class Jewish household. Now, there was always music around, but it was safe music, you know, family sing-alongs around the piano. But there is this one story from his childhood that I absolutely love because it shows his instinct wasn't just to play music, it was to construct it.
Oh, this is the math class story, right? I love this detail from the sources.
It's fantastic. So picture this. It's the mid-1930s. Kander is in the second grade. The rest of the class is up front, learning subtraction or multiplication, and little John is completely ignoring the teacher.
Naturally.
He's just scribbling notes on a piece of paper. He's literally writing a choral composition.
Which is precocious enough for a 7 or 8 year old.
But the kicker is, it's a Christmas carol.
And he's Jewish.
He is Jewish, and this is key. His teacher, instead of slapping his wrist for not doing his math, sees the talent. She actually arranges for the school choir to sing it at an assembly. But, and here is the polite mid-riff part of the story, she discreetly called his parents first to ask permission, basically saying, "I know you're Jewish. Are you okay with your son writing Christmas songs?"
That is surprisingly wholesome.
Mm?
But honestly, it's hard to draw a straight line from a second grade Christmas carol to the cell block tango in Chicago. Where does the darkness come from then?
Right. Where does that cynical edge originate? What it comes from a specific realization about artifice. There is this core memory in the biography that basically explains his entire aesthetic.
Okay, lay it on me.
He's 9 years old. The San Carlo Opera comes to Kansas City. His mom takes him to see Aida and Madama Butterfly.
Standard cultural enrichment for a nice kid.
Sure, but they're sitting in the front row, and Kander talks about this obsessively in interviews. He said he was close enough to see the makeup caked on the actors' faces, and specifically, he could clearly see the strings that were tying the fake beards onto the Egyptian soldiers.
With the strings on the beards, usually that ruins it for people.
Right.
That's the moment you go, oh, it's fake, and the magic dies. It's like seeing the zipper on the monster suit, and you just stop being scared.
Exactly. But for Kander, it did the exact opposite. He said, I could see the strings, and I loved it. It didn't break the spell at all. It made him obsessed with how the spell was cast.
He fell in love with the mechanics of the illusion.
Yes. He didn't want to be tricked. He wanted to see how the trick worked.
That actually makes a massive amount of sense when you fast forward 40 years. Think about Cabaret.
Oh, absolutely.
The MC is constantly breaking the fourth wall. He's looking right at the audience, welcoming them, reminding them they are in a club watching a show.
Precisely. Or look at Chicago, where the lawyer Billy Flynn treats a literal murder trial explicitly like a circus act. Kander's work is constantly saying to the audience, hey, look at the strings. Look at how fake this is.
And by showing us the fake, he reveals the uncomfortable truth underneath it all. It's almost like he's saying to you, if you know it's a show, you can see the manipulation happening.
And that entire perspective started in the front row in Kansas City, looking at a fake beard.
That is wild. So he has the passion. He goes to Oberlin and Columbia to study music properly under Douglas Moore. He's got the degrees. He's ready to take Manhattan. Hmm. But looking at this timeline, the 1950s were an absolute mess for him.
Oh, it was a bureaucratic nightmare.
It seems like the universe was actively trying to keep him out of the theater.
We have to talk about his military service because it reads like a comedy of errors. World War II is winding down. He joins the Merchant Marine Cadet Corps. He does the training sails to Asia, thinking he's done his bit. He gets out in May 1946.
Right, just in time to start a career.
You would think. But the government changed the draft rules that exact same month. So even though he got snatched right back up and forced into the Army Reserves.
You kidding?
Nope. Then fast forward a few years, the Korean War breaks out, and he gets called up again for active duty.
The man just cannot leave the military.
He's packed and ready to go to Korea. But during his pre-deployment physical, the doctor spots something on his x-ray. Scars on his lungs.
Oh, wow. Was it tuberculosis?
Probably a past infection he didn't even know he had. But it was serious enough that they grounded him. They ordered him to stay in New York City for 6 months of observation.
Wait, so he was essentially stuck in New York City?
Yes. And this is the ultimate sliding doors moment. Because of those lung scars, he wasn't shivering in a trench in Korea. He was physically grounded in Manhattan in the mid-50s, right when the golden age of Broadway was peaking.
If he passes that physical P, we probably never get Cabaret.
We never get Chicago. We never get any of it.
So he's in New York basically by accident. How does he actually get into the room where it happens? Does he just walk up to a producer with his resume?
No, he started from the absolute bottom. He got a job as a rehearsal pianist, but luck strikes again because he wasn't playing for just any show. He was the rehearsal pianist for West Side Story.
Oh, come on. So he's just hanging out in the room with Leonard Bernstein.
Bernstein and Jerome Robbins. And this is a really crucial technical point for us to understand from the sources. Being a rehearsal pianist isn't just sitting there playing the sheet music.
What else is it?
You are reacting to the dancers in real time. You are watching physical bodies move and adjusting the tempo to match them. You're part of the physical process of the scene.
So you're learning how music physically drives the action.
Exactly. And Jerome Robbins, the legendary choreographer, noticed Kander doing this. He basically told him you should write dance music.
Can we clarify what dance music means in this specific context? Because I think people hear that and think of a disco track. Is it just the songs they dance to?
No, and this is really important for understanding the Kander sound later on. In a musical, the dance music arranger is a very specific job. The composer writes the melody, the main song you sing. But when the characters break into a massive 5-minute dance break, the arranger has to take that original melody and stretch it.
Stretch it, twist it around?
Yeah, add rhythmic breaks, build tension, and create what's called a vamp. A vamp is that repeating musical figure, you know, dun, 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 that just loops until the singer or dancer is ready to come in. It creates suspense. It drives the energy forward. Kander cut his teeth, writing these complex arrangements for shows like Gypsy and Irma La Douce. He learned to write music that was functional. It had to sweat.
Music that sweats. I love that description.
And that is the literal birth of the Kander style. Think about the opening of Chicago, that rhythmic, pulsing beat.
Yeah, it's definitely not melodic and flowing like Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Not at all. It's percussive. It's driven entirely by movement. And that comes directly from his time watching dancers sweat in a rehearsal room.
So he's got the rhythm, he's got the technical chops, but a composer on Broadway is honestly nothing without a lyricist. You need the words.
Enter Fred Ebb.
Yes. This is 1962. They get introduced by a publisher named Tommy Volando. And usually these artistic partnerships take a long time to gel. You have to feel each other out, see if your styles match. But the sources say Kander and Ebb were almost instantaneous.
It was lightning fast. They wrote a song called My Coloring Book almost immediately, and it actually became a pop hit. Then they wrote I Don't Care Much for Barbra Streisand.
Which is a devastating song, by the way.
It's great.
If you haven't heard it, it's this slinky, weary ballad about being totally numb to the world.
It is. And it really set the tone for their whole career. Their stuff wasn't happy-go-lucky. It was weary. It was deeply cynical. And then in 1965, they got their very first Broadway show together called Flora the Red Menace.
Which, frankly, flopped.
Commercially, yes, it was a flop. But historically, it was massive because the lead actress in that show was a 19-year-old kid named Liza Minnelli.
The third point of the triangle.
Kander Ebb and Liza. They essentially wrote for her for the next 40 years.
Wow.
They understood that her specific voice had this frantic, desperate energy that matched Kander's rhythmic drive perfectly. They essentially created the Liza Minnelli persona through their songs.
So they have their muse. And then the late 60s hit. The world is changing rapidly. Vietnam, civil rights, the counterculture, the happy, shiny musicals of the 50s just don't make sense to audiences anymore. And Kander and Ebb drop Cabaret.
Cabaret in 1966, and then Chicago in 1975. These are what theater critics call concept musicals.
Let's define that for everyone. How is a concept musical different from a normal show?
Well, in a traditional musical like The Sound of Music or Oklahoma, the songs move the plot forward chronologically. It's very literal. I'm going to the store, so I'm singing a song about going to the store.
Right.
But in a concept musical, the songs are commentaries. They interrupt the narrative story to illustrate a broader theme. In Chicago, the plot literally stops so a character can sing a vaudeville number that explains their inner motivation, even if that song isn't literally happening inside the jail cell in the reality of the story.
It goes right back to the strings on the beards. They're using the format of a show to openly critique the characters.
Exactly. James Levy, who wrote a major biography on them, calls their work brittle. I've always loved that word for them.
Brittle. Like it's shiny but hard?
Yes, shiny but hard, and it might just shatter into pieces if you hit it too hard. Cabaret uses the setting of a sleazy nightclub to show the moral collapse of Germany. Chicago uses vaudeville tropes to show how the American justice system is just celebrity worship.
It's incredibly cynical stuff.
It is. And remember, Chicago was considered way too cynical when it first came out in 1975. It was too dark for audiences back then. It didn't win the big awards. It was only much later in the 2000s when the movie came out that the world kind of caught up and said, oh, actually, justice is a circus.
Best picture in 2002, by the way. But speaking of the world catching up, we have to talk about the monster in the room, the song. New York to New York.
The ultimate anthem.
I think 90% of people assume this was written for a stage show in the 1940s. Mm. It just sounds like it's always existed.
Right. It feels timeless. But it wasn't. It was written in 1977 for a Martin Scorsese movie that was also called New York, New York.
And there's a great story in the records about the first draft of this song. Kander and Ebb go to play the song for Scorsese and the star of the movie, Robert De Niro.
Imagine the pressure in that room. You're sitting at a piano with De Niro just staring at you. Kander plays the song. And De Niro, he absolutely hates it.
He hates it.
He thinks it's way too lightweight. He basically tells them it's not strong enough, try again. Now, a lot of composers, especially hugely successful ones, would have just stormed out. They'd say, I'm John Kander, who are you to tell me how to write music?
Yeah, the ego usually takes over.
But Kander is a craftsman above all else. He didn't have an ego about it. He just said, okay. He went home and wrote a completely new melody in 45 minutes.
45 minutes. And that second version is the one we all know.
That is the one, the pounding, stomping, iconic anthem.
It's incredible to think that a song rejected by an actor is now played at Yankee Stadium every single time they win a game.
It's bigger than the movie now. It's bigger than the composer. It's a perfect example of commercial art becoming actual civic identity. When you hear those opening notes, you don't think, oh, here's a John Kander song. You just think, New York City.
But here's a weird detail from the notes that blew my mind. They got nominated for an Oscar for that song, but they didn't win.
They lost. They had 11 Tony nominations for their stage work around that time, winning 4, but they lost the Oscar.
Do you know what won Best Original Song that year?
No, what was it?
You Light Up My Life.
You are kidding me.
I am not. History definitely gets the last laugh, I suppose.
Nobody is singing You Light Up My Life at the end of a marathon.
Exactly. But it shows you that immediate awards don't always measure true cultural longevity.
So Kander and Ebb are the absolute kings. They have the Tonys, they have the fame, the massive cultural footprint. But life happens. Fred Ebb passed away in 2004. Yeah. And this is the moment where the story usually ends for most legendary duos. Kander was in his late 70s at this point. He had just lost his creative partner of 42 years. You would entirely expect him to retire to the country and just collect royalty checks for the rest of his life.
But he didn't do that.
No. And this is what I find most inspiring about him, honestly. He didn't just keep working. He actively found new collaborators. He started working with playwrights like Greg Pierce and David Thompson.
And the newer shows weren't just rehashes of Cabaret, right?
Not at all.
No.
Look at things like The Landing in 2013 or Kid Victory in 2015, The Beast in the Jungle in 2018. These are dark, challenging, quite avant-garde pieces.
And then there's the modern connection that really ties it all together. The source material mentions Lin-Manuel Miranda.
The Hamilton guy himself.
It almost feels like a glitch in the timeline. Kander worked with Leonard Bernstein in the 1950s, and he's actively collaborating with Lin-Manuel Miranda in the 2020s.
It is mind-boggling when you lay it out like that. Miranda actually came in to write additional lyrics for the stage musical version of New York, which just premiered in 2023. He also collaborated on a track called Cheering For Me Now for his Hamel Drop series.
What does that tell us about Kander's specific style and his legacy?
It tells us he is the bridge. He is the living connective tissue of American musical theater history. He spans the entire modern era. He's not some museum relic. He is a working peer to the guys writing hits today. He can speak the classical language of the Golden Age and the rhythmic language of modern hip-hop theater seamlessly.
That is the definition of true longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to pivot just briefly to his personal life, because earlier we mentioned the polite Midwest upbringing. But Kander has been an openly gay man working in theater for decades.
Yes, though he's always been very private about it. He's been with his partner Albert Stevenson since 1977.
Wow, that is a long run.
Longer than most of his Broadway shows. They finally got legally married in Toronto in 2010. It's just another example of that core stability we've been talking about.
Yeah.
In a business that is famously full of chaotic personal lives and drama, Kander just stays steady. He goes home, he writes his music, he lives his life.
There's also a quick note here about a political connection in his family.
Yeah, his grandnephew is Jason Kander. He was the Secretary of State for Missouri and a pretty big name in national Democratic politics for a while.
So the Kander family as a whole is doing okay.
They're doing just fine.
Before we wrap this up, though, I have to ask about the ones that got away. Because for every massive hit like Chicago, there is a show that just crashes and burns. But the sources mention one specific project that sounds absolutely amazing, but never actually saw the light of day.
Oh, this is a real heartbreaker for theater nerds. Kander and Ebb spent a huge amount of time adapting Thornton Wilder's play, The Skin of Our Teeth.
That's the play with the dinosaurs.
Yes.
And the Ice Age and the suburban family, right? It's completely wild.
It's perfectly tailored for them. It's surreal. It's dark. It's funny. They wrote the entire score. They're ready to go into production. And then the rights got pulled.
By who?
Thornton Wilder's nephew. He controlled the literary estate, and he just said no at the very last minute.
That seems incredibly cruel.
It's the harsh reality of the business. Kander actually mentioned that the exact same thing happened to Harvey Schmidt and Tom Jones, the guys who wrote the Fantastics.
What happened to them?
They spent 13 years. 13 years adapting Our Town into a musical, and the exact same nephew pulled the rights from them, too.
13 years of work just gone. That's not a setback. That's a tragedy.
It really is. But Kander's attitude about it is basically, well, that's showbiz. You pack up the piano and you start writing the next one. And that deep resilience is a huge part of why he is still working at 98.
So we have a man who saw the strings on the Egyptian soldiers at age 9. A man who got stranded in New York by a medical fluke, who defined the cynical percussive sound of the 70s and is literally still writing today. What is a big takeaway here for us?
I think it's fundamentally about how we choose to listen. When you hear a Kander song, don't just let the razzle-dazzle wash over you. Kander isn't using the glitter to distract you from the darkness. He's using the glitter to highlight the darkness.
He makes the darkness danceable.
Exactly. He wants you to see the strings. He wants you to see that the system is rigged, that the romance is fake, that the politics were corrupt. And he wants you to tap your foot while you watch the whole thing burn down.
That is a terrifying and wonderful image.
It's the truth of his work. Show business isn't an escape for him. It's a mirror. It reflects the brittle reality of who we actually are.
Before we sign off, I want you to think about this because it builds right on what we're talking about.
Mm.
In our modern digital age, we are all essentially running our own little cabarets online.
Oh, that's a great point.
Right. We curate our feeds, we put on the makeup, we hide our own strings to present this perfect, polished show to our followers. We are all acting as our own MCs.
We really are.
So Kander's whole philosophy, exposing the artifice and showing the mechanics behind the glamour, it's honestly more relevant to our daily personal lives right now than it was to audiences in the 1960s. He was warning us about the danger of living inside a performance.
That is completely spot on.
So the next time you're at a wedding and New York comes on and everyone starts doing the high kicks on the dance floor,
just remember that you're singing a song about a guy who just wants to survive the grinder. You're singing about the grit, not just the glamour.
John Kander, everyone.
Oh!
The man behind the curtain. Thanks for diving in with us.
See you next time.